Today on the Monocle Arts Review, we're talking books with the writer and critic Mark Mason. Over the next quarter of an hour, we'll discuss three new books that have caught Mark's eye. First up, we'll journey back to the 1970s for a look at one of the best years in the history of pop music. That's in David Hepworth's 1971, Never a Dull Moment. We'll uncover a family's history through seven generations of its female characters in Juliet Nicholson's A House Full of Daughters. And we'll learn all the secrets hidden in the water around us in How to Read Water by Tristan Gooley. That's all ahead on today's Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. Stay tuned. When it comes to pop music, in 1971, there was never a dull moment. Or at least that's how writer and storied music magazine editor David Hepworth saw it. He's just written a new rock memoir focused in tightly on that year. Mark Mason, welcome to the show. Why was 1971 such an exciting year?
Well, if you believe David Hepworth, it's not because he just happened to be 20 or 21 in that year. He gets his defence against that early because, of course, your instant response is, you know, when you're young, the music stays with you and you think rock had its best year whenever you were young. His defence in the introduction is something along the lines of, the difference between you and me when I say it about 1971 is that I'm right. So he's got a nice arrogant opening. But then he's got some points that back it up. I mean, yes, there was a lot of great music in that year. There was Hunky Dory by Bowie, there was Led Zeppelin 4, there was Imagine by John Lennon, Every Picture Tells a Story by Rod Stewart, The Who Did Who's Next, The Stones did Sticky Fingers. There are a lot of great albums, but, and this is, I think, one of his most interesting points, the way the industry was changing, not just the music itself, that hi-fi had come along. You know, in the 60s, most record players were really basic things and you couldn't get much quality out of them. In the early 70s, you're starting to get really expensive, really good hi-fi equipment that's going to make it worth buying an album as opposed to a single. And then, of course, in turn, the record companies, someone like Ahmet Ertegun at Atlantic and all the other executives, realised that you can make a lot more money selling an album than you can from selling a single because the margin's bigger.
Right.
You know, when George Harrison's All Things Must Pass came out, that was £5 to buy. In the early 70s, that was a lot of money, and it sold millions. So there's that sort of change going on. And one of the big records of the year that the book keeps coming back to is Tapestry by Carole King. Sold tens of millions of copies. Interestingly, it was the first record to sell in any serious numbers to women. So there were lots of changes going on. I think Hepworth does make his case quite well that, you know, it's not just a case of I was young then and I loved all these albums, so I'm going to bore you about them. You know, there's more to it than that.
When you mentioned that, you know, women were buying a Tapestry, do you think that there's a kind of a bit of a message here that does he try and tie it to the social changes that were happening in the early 70s? Or is it very much about, you know, focused on the music and about the music?
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of great music. Like I say, you can't argue with that. Yeah. If Rod Stewart had put that album out 20 years before or 20 years afterwards, it would still have been a great album. As you know, as well as the social changes, there are things about how the records were made. Like on Carole King's Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow, two of the backing singers were James Taylor and Joni Mitchell. And David Hepworth's got a brilliant turn of phrase. He points out, and I quote, interesting casting since neither of them was a byword for fidelity singing on that particular song. And, you know, the way he paints great pictures of how the records were being made. That was as some of the Stones were recording down in the south of France at their big, huge mansion that they hired. Their clothing, again, I quote, their clothing apparently made up of whatever garment had been at the end of the bed when the noonday sun tickled them into wakefulness.
Fantastic.
It's written with a sense of humour. It's a lot of rock criticism can be very earnest and po-faced, and this certainly isn't that.
Oh, sorry, that's interesting. I mean, do you think we get Hepworth's reaction to when he kind of first heard all of this music? I mean, is it told through a series of anecdotes, and do we get that sense of excitement?
Yeah, not so much anecdotes about him. I thought there was going to be that. He mentions a record shop that he was hanging around in, but there's not too much in. There's just enough of him to make it interesting. But there are little vignettes of people who then weren't famous, what they were doing in that year as well. Barry Manilow. I never knew until I read this book that Barry Manilow had used to accompany Bette Midler, a gay sauna, the Continental Baths in New York City, where most of the audience were wearing only a towel, and so was Barry Manilow sitting at the piano.
How extraordinary.
What an image that is.
Yeah. And, I mean, does Hepworth kind of draw any comparisons to the music industry now? I mean, do you think there's a kind of message for today's pop fans?
Oh, yeah, it's incredible reading this, that just the amount of money that could be spent on making a record. And, you know, this is the start of them doing that, because albums, as we've been saying, albums sold those millions of copies at a huge margin. And there then wasn't the internet. You couldn't download it for free. You couldn't even download it at discounted places. You know, you just paid whatever the record stores charge you, which meant that the record companies became huge. So then they could start putting a lot of money into making them. You know, the Beatles famously made their first album in a day. Most of the 60s was operated like that. And the 70s are coming along. And he mentions at the end, he mentions the Eagles starting to make albums. Of course, it's funny looking back on it now, because then that turned into a lot of what we think of as the pompous, overblown, you know, very intellectual concept album rock of the 70s. So, yeah, I think that's one of the things that makes you realise you were on a cusp of things changing, which is what makes it an interesting book, I think.
1971, Never a Dull Moment by David Hepworth is out now, published by Bantam Press. Our second book today, A House Full of Daughters, is an exploration of one historian's ancestry through seven generations of women. Juliet Nicholson uncovers a few family truths as she tells the story of her distant past that takes us from 19th century Malaga to an English boarding school during the Second World War and New York City in the 80s. Mark, what sort of characters does Nicholson unveil in this book?
She unveils the seven characters who are the seven female generations of her family, going from all the way from her grandmother's grandmother through herself and then down to her own granddaughter, who's a couple of years old. It's one of those things, especially I think I've got more out of this book now that I'm a father than I would have done before I had children. It's one of those things that having children makes you realise the similarities in your family, both looking forward. Sometimes I look at my son and I think, oh my God, I do that. You know, it's even just a facial expression looks just like you, and you think, right. Oh, I've got to be careful here. You know, sort of monitoring your own behaviour. And then, of course, going back to previous generations. With me, of course, it's male. You know, I see lots of similarities between my father, me, and my son. With Juliet Nicholson, she's talking about the women in her family. And as much as things change, going from her grandmother's grandmother, who was one of Europe's most famous dancers, who people were captivated all over Europe by her. She grew up, she was born in poverty, and because of her success on the stage, she became very successful. And she had a slightly fanciful mother who used to boast about her daughter, the dancer. And she used to boast that her daughter was enjoying a romance with the Emperor of Germany. The only problem being that Germany didn't have an emperor at the time. She was making these things up. But then she ends up as a heavy drinker, Pepita, who's the dancer, and she ends up washing her four-year-old daughter's hair in the leftover dregs of champagne. It's incredible. Wow. And drink does feature heavily. Juliet Nicholson herself was a serious drinker. Vita Sackville-West, who's Juliet Nicholson's grandmother, who famously started the garden at Sissinghurst Castle in Kent. She would just be found lying dead drunk in the flower beds by the gardeners, and they would then have to take her back to the house in a wheelbarrow.
Wow.
These patterns do come up. As much as there's no way you could compare someone born in poverty in Spain in the 19th century, in 1830, nearly 200 years ago, actually, her granddaughter has just the same problems with drink, and these patterns keep coming up, and parents hiding things from their children as well. That's another a pattern that comes up in the book.
I see. How is it that the sort of narrative structured? Does it go through chronologically from the great-great-grandmother to the grandmother? And then what happens when Juliet Nicholson gets to herself?
She gets to herself. She, first of all, she's telling the story of her childhood, which again is sort of half comic and half tragic. It's one of those books that remind you that comedy and tragedy are two sides of the same coin. They're very often the same thing happening. You can turn it into a sitcom, or you can turn it into the blackest, bleakest tragedy. There's one point where her mother sits her down, that Juliet Nicholson's own mother, Philippa, sits her down, and she says, "What?" At this point, she's 12. It's on her 12th birthday. And her mother says to her, "What I'm going to tell you, this thing about what a man does to a woman to get a baby, sounds disgusting," she said, crossing her legs as she lit a Benson and Hedges and exhaled the smoke with force. "And it is." So that's simultaneously very, we're laughing at it, but actually when you think about it, it's a woman saying that to her 12-year-old daughter.
Quite sad, yeah.
It's fascinating.
And is this interesting as a kind of social document as well? I mean, are we exploring the times that they're living in, or is it sort of just a family history?
Of course, yeah, both. It's definitely her grandfather, Nigel Nicholson. Sorry, I'm getting my generations mixed up now. Juliet Nicholson's father, Nigel Nicholson, marries her mother, Philippa, and he tries to persuade everyone, including himself, that he's doing it for love. But actually he's doing it because this is back in the 40s or the 50s, it's late 40s, early 50s, I think, doing it because he's an unmarried Tory MP and people are starting to talk. And his father says to him, "Can she open a bazaar well?" "She'll have to learn," replies Nigel. You know, that the sort of thought of that sort of thing happening now is just untrue. You know, but even going back to the 80s, the fact that Juliet Nicholson could function as as an alcoholic working in publishing in the 1980s. Everything's that sort of industry's changed completely now.
A House Full of Daughters by Juliet Nicholson is out now, published by Chatto and Windus. Our final book today teaches us how water can be used as more than just a source of rehydration. How to Read Water by Tristan Gooley explores seas, rivers, ponds and puddles around the world and explains how the tide works, how you can forecast the weather from waves and read the sea like a Viking. Mark, it doesn't sound like a particularly riveting subject, I have to say. Why did you like it?
Well, I thought exactly the same going into it. But I had a look at it and I realised very quickly that he's not one of those scientists who's very po-faced about things. In fact, he's not a scientist at all. He's just someone who's got a keen interest in nature. And then you start to think, this isn't one of his lines, this is one of my thoughts as I read it, that water accounts for 70% of our planet and 60% of our bodies. And it's the most important thing you could see. You know, famously, the human body can survive much longer without food than it can without drink. But we just don't consider it. And so he goes through... one of his own quotes, he says, "I rail against the naturalists who think that knowing the name of a plant is better than knowing its character." It's written from experience, this sort of book. It's not a textbook. And he gives the example of he was out on a walk one day and went past a puddle and noticed the ripples in the puddle and noticed that they weren't going from side to side. So they couldn't have been caused by wind. And anyway, there wasn't any wind. So he knew they couldn't have been wind ripples, waves in the puddle. The ripples were actually coming out from the centre of the puddle. And he thought, there must have been something in it. So he retreated a few yards away and hid himself behind a tree and then watched as the bird that had been having its bath in the puddle and that he'd scared off by walking by came back to carry on with its bath.
Wow.
So it's a really practical thing. It's a nice little stories like that. And then also just the astonishing facts that a cube of water with sides the length of an average person's height weighs nearly 3 tons.
Wow.
I know.
Oh, amazing.
Astonishing stuff.
I mean, how is it structured? Is it that kind of thing? Is it just anecdote after anecdote? Or is there a kind of a plot, I guess, that runs through it?
Yeah, it goes through in themes, you know, the sea and puddles and also rivers. There's a whole chapter on rivers. Some of the language is beautiful. The line of greatest depth along a river is called the Thalweg. Thalweg. And that's when he gives you a little tip if you want to win at poo sticks. That by and large, this is a pretty infallible rule, the stick nearest the centre of the river will always win.
Okay, that's a good tip.
So, if you want to make yourself some money with your toddler the next time you're out playing poo sticks.
I mean, is that part of what makes this interesting? You know, the way he writes, is his prose kind of powerful and
it's fascinating? It's like talking to a guy in the pub.
Right.
It's not aiming to be a great literary work. It's just, you know, it's very difficult to write like this. I mean, that's why I'm saying what's good about it. It reads as though you're listening to someone telling you the stuff in a pub. And little things you can try out for yourself, like if you're walking along a path and look at the puddles, there will be more puddles on the south side of the path because the undergrowth that's growing at the side of the path shields that side of the path from the sun. So the puddles don't dry out as quickly, you see. So,
in the Northern Hemisphere,
so buyers, now you're getting clever. You sound almost as clever as him. You should be writing your own book along these lines. Yes, that's right, isn't it? Yes.
I think so, maybe.
I'm sure we'll get emails if it's not.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, do you think there's been a bit of a kind of renaissance in interest in these kind of books about nature? There seem to be, we've had a few on the Arts Review recently.
Yeah, Tristan Gooley himself, his previous books were The Walker's Guide to Outdoor Clues and Signs and The Natural Navigator. I think there's more of them. Popular science generally, I think, has boomed as a genre in publishing. And this is just a particular one that you can apply yourself. Anyone going out on a walk, you know, can have a look at the path and see. And also, if you get two paths, if there's a T-junction at a path, the puddle that's formed on the side going towards the nearest village or whichever way most people head for whatever reason will be slightly bigger.
Right.
So if you're lost and you want to head back to the village, you could look at the two puddles and compare them that way. They're
fantastic.
You know, and of course cynics would say, well, you can do that with your iPhone these days, but yeah, you know, it's just nice to be able to do these things in a different way.
Exactly. Why would you look at your phone when you've got a puddle there to read?
If you live in my part of the countryside, you wouldn't be getting any signal on your phone anyway, so
okay.
You couldn't use it to
How to Read Water by Tristan Gooley is out now, published by Scepter. And I'm afraid that brings us to the end of today's show. Thanks very much to my guest, Mark Mason. Remember to tune in to our other weekly books programme, Meet the Writers, this Saturday at 1500 London time, when Georgina Godwin will be talking to American mystery and thriller writer Harlan Coben. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. This show was produced by Holly Fisher. Join us again at the same time tomorrow for our weekly film chat with Karen Krizanovich. But for now, thanks very much for listening and goodbye.